KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump asserted direct power over stock markets, workplace rules, and consumer safety. What happens if independent federal agencies become less independent? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, President Trump attacks Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, calling him a dictator. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We'll look at Trump and Zelensky's relationship over the years and what it could mean for talks about peace in Ukraine. Also, centuries-old recipes from the first black woman we know of in America to write her own cookbook, and L.A. debates how to rebuild after deadly wildfires. It is Thursday, February 20th. On this day in 1939, more than 20,000 people attended a Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden, the largest ever in the U.S. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The government entity called DOGE is claiming that it has saved taxpayers billions of dollars. This week, the Trump administration launched a website that tracks these savings, but NPR's Stephen Fowler says the claimed savings are not as rosy as DOGE says they are.
The claims weren't off by just a little bit, but rather overstated by billions. Half of these savings claimed in these receipts comes from what DOGE said was actually a typo entered into the federal contract database a few years ago that made a listing worth up to $8 million look like $8 billion. That typo was fixed in the system a few weeks ago, but only fixed on the DOGE website yesterday.
NPR's Stephen Fowler reporting. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke by phone today with several European leaders. NPR's Polina Litvinova reports the leaders have held a second meeting in Paris.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was among those who assured Ukraine of their support. He published a video on X saying Canada will always stand up for Ukraine.
Canada and our allies are unequivocal on standing up against Vladimir Putin's illegal, immoral, unjust violations of the international order.
After President Trump criticized Ukraine's leader for not holding elections during the war and called him a dictator, some European leaders spoke up in support of Zelensky. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said it was dangerous to deny Zelensky's legitimacy. The Ukrainian constitution prohibits elections during martial law, which was announced in 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine. Polina Litvinova, NPR News.
Israel has received the bodies of four Israeli hostages held in captivity in Gaza. They included a young mother and her two children. The fourth body was that of an older man. Hamas is scheduled to release six living hostages on Saturday. In exchange, Israel is to free about 600 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Stocks opened sharply lower this morning after a cautious sales forecast from Walmart. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials fell about 400 points in early trading.
Walmart reported strong sales and profits for its most recent quarter, but the retail giant is warning of a possible slowdown in the months to come as cautious shoppers keep a tight grip on their wallets, and President Trump's tariff moves threaten to put upward pressure on prices. New applications for unemployment benefits showed little change last week. Widespread job cuts in the federal government have yet to show up in the data. Republican Congressman Don Bacon is urging the government to be more thoughtful about those job cuts after the Agriculture Department mistakenly fired workers who were fighting the bird flu outbreak. Cuts the department is now trying to reverse, Humpty Dumpty style. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Temperatures are still frigid in much of the central U.S. this morning. In Bismarck, North Dakota, it's 22 degrees below zero. With the wind chill, it feels like more than 40 degrees below zero. It's been really cold for days in the plains, and the National Weather Service says that widespread record cold will continue through tomorrow. Weather forecasters say that a warming trend will arrive by the weekend. Philadelphia is saying goodbye to the SS United States. It has been docked in the city for nearly 30 years. Now, the historic ocean liner is starting its final voyage. From member station WHYY, Matt Gillum reports the vessel is poised to set one more record.
The nearly 1,000-foot-long SS United States is finally on its way to begin its transformation into the biggest artificial reef in the world. The now rusting but stately ocean liner set the transatlantic speed record in both directions on its 1952 maiden voyage, a record it still holds. The rise of the jet age proved the ship's downfall, and it left active service in 1969. Dubbed America's flagship, the SS United States is bound for Alabama, where it'll be cleaned and prepared for its final resting place, on the seafloor in the warm waters off the Florida Panhandle. For NPR News, I'm Matt Gillum in Philadelphia.
Former Democratic U.S. Senator from Oklahoma and Governor David Boren has died at the age of 83, according to his family. He'd had a long illness. Boren served several terms in the Oklahoma State House before becoming a U.S. Senator. After leaving Congress, Boren was president of Oklahoma's largest public university, retiring in 2018. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Coming up, to rebuild or not to rebuild? That's the dilemma after a disaster. In a few minutes, we'll take a look at how people in Los Angeles are thinking about this after the recent wildfires.
First, we examine an effort to rebuild the federal government. President Trump is working to expand his power. Two big questions have come up again and again in recent weeks. What should the government do? And who decides? In an executive order signed this week, Trump tells agencies that oversee stock markets and election spending and broadcasting and more to get with the program, his program. The president appoints the heads of these agencies, which by law and tradition are supposed to operate with some independence. Russ Vogt, the president's budget director, wants to take that independence away. He spoke with me on this program in 2023.
The notion of an independent agency, whether that's a flat-out independent agency like the FCC or a agency that has parts of it that view itself as independent like the Department of Justice, we're planting a flag and saying we reject that notion completely.
And that flag the administration has now planted challenges decades of precedent. So let's talk it through with Jane Manners, who's a law professor at Temple University. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, part of what we're talking about here are, I guess you'd call them alphabet agencies. He mentioned the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. There's the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. There's a bunch of others. How did the United States come to have those kinds of agencies?
It's a great question and a useful story to help us understand what their purpose is. So the generally understood first independent agency was the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was established by Congress in 1887 to regulate railroad rates. And this was a really heated political issue of the day. States had been regulating railroad rates with some success. Congress decided it needed to be a federal project. You really had to have interstate regulation, and they wanted to do it right. So they wanted to get people deciding what those rates were and deciding when railroads had violated them. And they wanted those people to be experts. They went around the country. They interviewed a lot of people to talk about how to set this up right. They looked at the state experience, and they decided that the best way to do this was to create a commission comprising people from both parties. And they talked about men of expertise and knowledge. They wanted them to be well compensated and well insulated. And what that meant was they didn't want them to be subject to the vagaries of politics, where they could be removed at will, because they wanted their decisions to be independent and protected from that sort of political pressure.
I've been interested as I followed this. I know there's a bunch of other agencies that have grown up over time in the 1930s. And the Depression, you got these agencies that expanded, and you have more and more commissions. They're presidentially appointed commissions, so they're under the president, but you said well insulated from politics. I get the impression that someone like Russ Vogt, the president's budget director, doesn't buy the idea at all of non-political decision making.
That's right. I mean, Russ Vogt has spoken, he's mentioned a few reasons in the past for why independent agencies raise a problem in his view. The one he's been stressing recently is that the fact that they are not 100% accountable to the president is a problem in terms of their overall accountability. The idea, who do they answer to? And that is a vision of accountability that makes sense on first hearing. But I would say, when you think about the kind of accountability that you want in a decision-making body that is making sensitive decisions about the stock market, about communications, about elections, it's hard to imagine, for instance, having a commission that oversees elections whose accountability is structured by their kind of complete answerability to the president's ability to remove at will.
I feel like the key word here is ambiguity. We have this idea in many parts of the government, this kind of ambiguous authority. The president is in charge. He's giving general policy directions. He's actually appointing board members and so forth. But he kind of keeps hands off and keeps things a little bit ambiguous. People follow his direction, but not too directly. And the new administration is saying we're wiping that out. No ambiguity. Is that correct?
I think that's right. And there's also, but there are also kind of legal structures, right? So the way these independent commissions have been set up is you have this generally a commission, not always, that is set up with to serve a term of years, like you serve a term of 4 years, but you can be removed in discrete instances. Generally, it's inefficiency, neglect of duty, and malfeasance in office, kind of a little word salad, but it basically means if you really can't do your job, or you just refuse to do your job, or you're malfeasant, like you're engaged in exploitation and corruption, then you can be removed. But outside of those reasons, the law structures it as, you know, president hands off to kind of create that sort of independence.
And now we have the government, the administration, giving specific instructions to a bunch of different agencies, more directly looking at the Justice Department and even getting into the Federal Reserve in the last couple of days. The argument for this is accountability, as we've heard, but what is the argument against it?
The argument, so for the Department of Justice, the Department of Justice is not an independent agency, but since Watergate, there have been strong norms against presidential control of the Department of Justice. To kind of, you know, these norms arose after the scandals involving Nixon. And the norms for that are you want your procedures and your independent decision-making to really kind of legitimate the government's adjudication of particular problems. You don't want everything to be politics all the way down.
Just about 15 seconds left. Are a lot of laws being broken here or challenged here at the very least?
There are certainly laws being challenged, right? The idea that the White House controls the spending of independent agencies and that the White House gets to determine the meaning of the laws that the independent agencies enforce challenge the structure of those agencies.
Jane Manners, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's an old debate in the world of disaster recovery, and it has been reopened by last month's deadly wildfires in Los Angeles. The question is, should rebuilding be encouraged in places that are known to be at high risk for more disasters? NPR's Kirk Sigler reports on how LA is trying to recover and strike a balance.
In a grocery store parking lot in Altadena recently, a long line snaked behind a food truck with donated clothes and free lunches. Shirley Dozier happened to be driving by and gratefully pulled over.
Yeah, and they're all over the place, which is nice because people are just completely lost. Nothing, you know.
Dozier, who's retired, now also has nothing. The house she's owned in Altadena since the 70s burned down. She's trying to stay positive, she says, taking it day by day.
Like I say, I'm 79. It's going to take 5 or 6 years before you get back up there to make it look right. So I'm just thinking, you know, maybe I'll take the money and run or don't know.
Whether to take the insurance money and run is something a lot of folks are considering across this vast, expensive city. If recent deadly wildfires in the West are any indication, it will be years before Altadena is rebuilt. The scale of devastation is huge.
This utility crew in front of me is just finishing putting up a replacement pole, and all around me is just destruction.
Beneath these poles, burnt cars and the eerie skeletons of home foundations. After disasters, the first move is to get the power back on so cleanup and rebuilding can start. But what if it just burns again? Diana Lieb got her family out in time, but they lost everything. She hadn't been back yet.
I haven't had the opportunity, and also I don't think I'm that ready yet.
The house she and her husband bought 9 years ago burned down. So did their daughter's school.
It's not the kind of neighborhood where you would think, oh, this is so rural that, you know, of course there was a fire here. You know, like, I've been hearing a lot of victim blaming like that.
Victim blaming by commentators and social media feeds, mostly from outside the city, asking why California continues to sprawl into high-risk fire zones. Lee bought in Altadena because it was one of the last affordable places in L.A., and her home was built in 1929.
You wouldn't imagine that our entire little mountain town would just be incinerated.
Before the fires, L.A. County was already moving to restrict development in dangerous places, including parts of Altadena. But most of the neighborhoods that burned in the Eaton Fire were not even in state-designated high-risk zones. Now there's pressure on planners to throw out all the severity maps and start over.
This is a catastrophe that no one expected or anticipated.
Amy Bodak is head of planning for L.A. County.
In this case, the answer is we are committed to rebuilding Altadena.
She says the county will make it as easy as possible for fire survivors to rebuild, but there are caveats.
Anyone whose property burned down absolutely has the right to rebuild. If they happen to own properties in the hillside, they can rebuild what they had, but not more than that.
This is the tension local leaders face after big fires like the deadly ones on Maui or after the campfire in Paradise, California. They don't want to just set people up for another disaster. But on the other hand, there's pressure to help people rebuild and to make it affordable by cutting red tape or even exempting them from some of the tougher new safety codes. At UCLA, researcher Edith DeGuzman urges caution.
If the red tape that we're cutting also touches upon shortcuts that have to do with fire readiness and home hardening, then we will be doing these communities a great disservice.
But LA planners told me there's only so much a government can do to shape rebuilding when, in the end, it comes down to individual people's decisions about their private property.
There are a couple bags of donations that we got that I still have to sift through. So
this is what Diana Lieb is wrestling with. She says she's grateful to be living in her parents' house here in West LA. They couldn't find anywhere to rent.
We want to. The answer is yes, we want to rebuild, but the reality of it financially is not looking great.
It's a lot. Can they get insurance? Do they even want to try to rebuild at the scene of so much trauma? After the 2018 campfire, for instance, some decided it wasn't worth all the stress or the expense of rebuilding to safer wildfire codes. And 5 years later, only a third of Paradise had repopulated. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air, Rich Benjamin, whose maternal grandfather was president of Haiti in 1957, but after 19 days was overthrown by a military coup. We'll talk about getting classified documents showing America's role in the coup, and hear about Benjamin's experiences as a Black, gay, Haitian American who came out during the AIDS epidemic. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's morning again from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Thousands of miles from Washington, D.C., President Trump's decision to cut foreign aid has begun to affect many people whose lives depend on U.S. assistance. They include the Rohingya refugees living in Bangladesh. Shamim Chowdhury visited their camps and filed this report from Cox's Bazar.
Inside the world's largest refugee camp, in a remote corner of southern Bangladesh, a sense of uncertainty hangs in the air. We're at a US-funded clinic operated by a humanitarian agency, the International Rescue Committee, or IRC. The humming of medical equipment reminds us that it's well stocked. At least 26,000 refugees rely on the clinic's services, but these days few have access to them.
It's the middle of the afternoon at this clinic, and there's not a single patient waiting to be seen.
Last year, the U.S. contributed $301 million, or 55%, of all foreign aid for the Rohingya. But since Trump suspended most of USAID's overseas funding, this clinic and four others are offering emergency services only. The suspension is temporary, pending a three-month review, and it doesn't affect food funding. Last week, a U.S. federal judge ordered a temporary lifting of the aid freeze, but the clinic we visited told us it hasn't resumed full services. We meet Nurjahan, her only name. She's 58, her tiny frame covered in sun-baked skin. She suffers from hypertension and can barely manage the 10-minute walk to the clinic. Before the funding freeze, doctors here would test her blood pressure daily and adjust her medication accordingly. But now she's told she can only be seen twice a week.
Whenever we get sick, we come here and get medicine. If this place stops running, how will we get treatment?
The Rohingya, a mostly Muslim ethnic minority, lived for centuries in Myanmar's western Rakhine state. But they were effectively stripped of their citizenship in 1982. Since then, waves of them fled Myanmar, mainly to Bangladesh, with around 700,000 arriving in 2017 after suffering what the United Nations called a textbook case of ethnic cleansing by Myanmar. Now there are more than a million refugees cramped inside these camps. Their future remains bleak, and with foreign aid declining since the COVID pandemic, it's getting worse. As Shari Nijman, spokesperson for the United Nations Humanitarian Council for Refugees, explains.
Most refugees are still almost completely reliant on humanitarian aid. So when we've seen that aid go down, support needs to be cut somewhere. And for us, it means that the services that we can provide these refugees will dip below the standard of humanitarian care that we want to give.
But it's not just USAID cuts. The Trump administration has also made changes in other areas. Last month, it suspended a resettlement program for some Rohingya. We meet one man whose hopes have been shattered. Mohammed Hassan lingers beside a table tennis game at a youth center where he once worked. He tries to focus, but his gaze keeps drifting. He came to Bangladesh in 1992 and applied to move to the US in 2021. Last April, his refugee application was approved. But just 5 days after Trump's inauguration, the process was suspended. the International Organization for Migration had been facilitating the move. It told NPR that it was unable to provide a comment. Hassan is devastated.
I have four children. I have a wife. My daughter asks when she will go to that faraway place where she can go to school. My sorrow is such that not a week goes by when I don't have tears in my eyes.
He wipes away his tears. A few miles along the coast, in the city of Cox's Bazar, we meet Mizanur Rahman, Bangladesh's most senior official responsible for the Rohingya. His warning is stark.
If the suspension goes as permanent declaration of, you know, withdrawing the support from this crisis response, it will be a disaster for this humanitarian crisis response.
If that happens, he says, the people described by the UN as the most persecuted on earth stand to suffer even more. For NPR News, I'm Shamim Chowdhury in the Rohingya refugee camps in southern Bangladesh.
Connoisseurs of cookbooks know a fact about them. The recipes are only half the fun. The recipes may not even be that original. What makes a cookbook distinct, if anything, is the author's story, which is definitely true of a cookbook that is being republished after a century and a half. Here's NPR's Netta Ulaby.
Melinda Russell wrote this cookbook in 1866. We know sadly little about her, says Professor Rafia Zafar.
She's widowed early. She has a handicapped child. She starts her own business. She has a pastry shop.
That shop may explain why you can find at least 100 recipes for sweets in her book, called A Domestic Cookbook. The sweets are old-fashioned. Allspice cake, French lady cake, lemon puffs, boiled berry pudding. They still sound delicious. Melinda Russell was never enslaved. She became the first black woman in America that we know of to write her own cookbook soon after the end of the Civil War.
She lived in North Carolina. She lived in Tennessee. But she had to leave the South because of what she said, her Union principles.
She ended up in Paw Paw, Michigan.
So today I'm making Melinda Russell's drop ginger cake.
On YouTube, people like Matthew Gillen pay tribute to Melinda Russell by making her recipes. This video is part of an online cooking series from the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
That goes all together in a pot.
It's not easy to adapt 160-year-old recipes to the age of the Instapot, says Rafia Zafar. Here's an example from Russell's cookbook.
This is the recipe. 1 pound flour, 1 ditto butter, 9 eggs, 2 quarts milk, a little yeast, mixed together warm. That's the recipe.
Zafar finds it fun to read old recipes, she says, because they take you on a journey.
People always say reading cookbooks are like reading novels, but reading cookbooks are also like reading ethnographies and travel books.
Time travel books. And in this Black History Month in 2025, what a joy, she says, to meet a determined, resourceful heroine in Melinda Russell, who reminds readers today how creativity and talent have circulated and survived. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
We know the saying, there are a lot of fish in the sea. But just how many fish? Well, we asked one scientist.
We really don't know how many fish there are in the sea, and we don't know how those numbers fluctuate year after year.
But they're getting a better sense of fish populations in deep, dark ocean waters by turning to elephant seals for answers. On All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. In the Middle East today, Hamas returned the bodies of 4 Israelis taken hostage in southern Israel 16 months ago. It was part of the ongoing ceasefire agreement between Israel and the Palestinian militant group. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi says in exchange, Israel is expected to release hundreds of Palestinians from Israeli jails.
A large crowd of Palestinians gathered at a ceremony in the city of Khan Yunis, south of Gaza, to watch the four coffins transfer to the International Committee of the Red Cross. NPR's Gaza producer Enes Baba was at the scene.
The stage was like a theater, closed with black curtains, and behind it, there was two missiles and four coffins. There was a picture or portrait of Netanyahu himself with blood all over his face and with his own teeth that looked like a vampire.
Israeli officials confirmed they had received the coffins of the dead Israelis. They said the bodies would undergo forensic testing to confirm the identities. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News.
A Senate confirmation vote is expected today on Kash Patel, President Trump's nominee to serve as director of the FBI. The Trump administration's ongoing efforts to downsize government will include more than 6,000 employees at the Internal Revenue Service. The New York Times says they're expected to be let go before the end of the week. This is NPR News. The Trump administration is ordering New York City to halt its congestion pricing program. It charges drivers $9 to enter Manhattan during peak hours. As Stephen Nesson with member station WNYC reports, the Transportation Department is rescinding approval for the toll.
In a letter to New York Governor Kathy Hochul, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says the tolling program that was approved by the Biden administration should have never been given the green light. But Hochul says the toll has reduced traffic in the city, boosted local businesses, and that she vows to fight the administration.
I don't care if you love congestion pricing or hate it. This is an attack on our sovereign identity, our independence from Washington. And this is... We are a nation of states.
MTA officials filed a lawsuit against the Transportation Department, and for now, Hochul says the tolling cameras are staying on. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Nesson in New York.
Beginning today, Major League Baseball will be testing out computerized umpires at its spring training exhibition games. Cameras will track pitches to determine whether they're balls or strikes. The systems are being tested in 13 spring training ballparks in Florida and Arizona. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump sounds like he's changing U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine, which the United States has supported up to now in its defense against Russia's invasion. In attacks on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Trump has called him a dictator for not holding elections during wartime, and Trump falsely blames Zelensky for Russia's attack on Ukraine, which is Russia's version of events. These two presidents have a history that dates back to 2019, when Trump in his first term was looking for dirt on a political rival. Here's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez.
6 years ago, President Trump was on a call with a then relatively new Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, when Trump asked for a favor. that request to investigate then former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter would go on to reshape Trump's presidency.
Well, I made a perfect call, not a good call, perfect call.
At the time, Zelensky tried his best to stay out of the political mess.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be involved to democratic, open, elections of USA.
He couldn't escape it entirely, though, and Trump was eventually impeached by the House for soliciting interference in the 2020 election, but then acquitted by the Senate.
President Trump carries a lot of baggage and very negative baggage in terms of his views of President Zelensky.
That's Andrea Kendall Taylor, a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. She says Trump never had much respect for Zelensky, but also never got over Zelensky's role in the scandal.
That definitely colors the lens through which he is approaching these negotiations with Russia and his sidelining of Zelensky in the process.
It's a complex relationship, though. Charles Kupchan, who served as a senior advisor on European affairs in the Obama White House, says like many relationships Trump has with foreign leaders, it can take many forms.
I think the relationship between Trump and Zelensky, like the relationship between Trump and all other leaders, blows hot and cold.
On the campaign trail, for example, Trump mocked Zelensky for being a great salesman, accused him of trying to help Democrats, and, quote, making little nasty aspersions toward him. Yet when they met in person, Trump said it was an honor to meet with Zelensky. The fact is, Kupchan says, both leaders are very transactional.
But the bottom line is that Trump needs Zelensky because he can't end the war without Zelensky's help. And Zelensky needs Trump because he knows that if Ukraine is to emerge from this war as a sovereign, secure democracy, the United States has to be there to help them.
Zelensky has repeatedly tried flattery to win Trump over, but Zelensky's been pushing back more recently after being excluded from negotiations between the U.S. and Russia over ending the war. Zelensky told reporters that as much as he respects Trump, that the U.S. president is amplifying Russian disinformation, including blaming Zelensky for Russia's invasion.
Today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
While he claims to like Zelensky on a personal level, Trump continues to echo Putin's worldview, says Heather Conley, who was the top U.S. diplomat to Central Europe under George W. Bush.
The president is really delivering Russian talking points about the illegitimacy of President Zelensky.
And she says by siding with the aggressor, Russia, Trump also risks making the aggressor stronger. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
What's going to happen to New York City Mayor Eric Adams? We still aren't sure. To recap, the Justice Department requested to throw out corruption charges filed against Adams. There was a hearing yesterday in Manhattan where the DOJ argued that the department can make decisions about criminal prosecutions in part based on President Trump's political agenda. The DOJ wants to pause the charges so Adams can help the White House crack down on migrants in the U.S. without legal status. The federal judge who presided over the hearing said he needed more time to think about this. NPR's Brian Mann was in court, and he's here with us to tell us more about it. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Tell us more about the argument made by the Justice Department.
Yeah, so the man appearing in court for the DOJ yesterday was Acting Assistant Attorney General Emile Beauvais. He used to be one of President Trump's personal lawyers. Yesterday, Beauvais argued the Trump administration wants Mayor Adams free to help pursue undocumented migrants. Beauvais argued that prosecuting Adams on corruption and bribery charges would hinder and burden the mayor's ability to do that. Beauvais said national security is at stake.
So let me just be clear about this. The Justice Department, or at least the argument that Beauvais made yesterday, wasn't saying that charges should not have been brought because Adams is innocent. The argument he made is that Adams is useful to the White House, so he shouldn't be prosecuted.
That's right. Beauvais made this case repeatedly and clearly to Judge Dale Ho. The DOJ also laid out this argument in its memo requesting the case be shelved. That memo says explicitly the decision to stop this case isn't based on the merits or the evidence. The motive, and I'm reading now, Michelle, from the DOJ's memo, is the concern about the impact of the prosecution on Mayor Adams' ability to support critical ongoing federal efforts to protect the American people from the disastrous effects of unlawful mass migration. Now, at least seven DOJ attorneys have resigned rather than go along with this Justice Department decision. Three other former federal prosecutors wrote a legal brief that was discussed in the courtroom yesterday, all describing this mingling of politics and criminal law as a dangerous precedent.
Did the judge give any indication about how he sees all this?
Well, first, Judge Ho acknowledged he has limited authority here. A DOJ request of this kind is normally a slam dunk. It's more or less rubber stamped by the courts. But yesterday, the judge made it clear he thinks this case really is different. This is a very complicated situation, at least from where I sit, Ho said. And so at the end of the hearing, he declined to offer a quick ruling. He says he needs more time to sort through this, but he promised a ruling soon.
And as we said, this all began with corruption charges against Mayor Adams. Did he have anything to say yesterday?
Adams has denied any wrongdoing in all this. He walked right past me going into the courthouse yesterday, and he sounded upbeat. This is all part of the process, he said. He says he will not resign and plans to run for a second term in this year's election. But here's the thing, Michelle, Adams is still under enormous pressure. New York Governor Kathy Hochul's weighing whether to use her authority to force Adams from office. She met with civic and political leaders here in Manhattan this week after four of Adams' deputy mayors quit. So we don't know how all this is going to play out. What we do know is that this case has huge national significance, giving us an early look at how President Trump's Justice Department will operate. And this scandal could still topple the mayor of the country's biggest city.
That is NPR's Brian Mann in New York City. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Novel. Back after this, a podcast editor gets a big break hosting her own show. The catch, it would be about her own love life. That's next time on Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today. Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. The SS United States left Philadelphia yesterday, destined for a new life at the bottom of the ocean. But that fate is not as sad as it sounds. The ocean liner, which was built in the 1950s, was once considered a marvel of American engineering, but it's been in disrepair for decades and is now being towed south. Eventually, it will be sunk off the coast of Florida. Officials there hope it will become a star attraction for divers and sea life as an artificial reef. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a story this morning about owls who flew south for the winter to Minnesota. They're owls from Canada, so Minnesota is their snowbird refuge this year. Bird enthusiasts are flocking to see them, which turns out is not so good for the owls. Dan Crocker of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Last month, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources naturalist Michaela Rice got a report of a dead owl on the side of a highway along the north shore of Lake Superior. Rice says it looked like a turkey. It was so big.
I picked it up. It was incredibly light carcass. It felt like it was made out of styrofoam.
Then they saw the huge round face and Rice knew it was a great gray. At about 2 feet, they're North America's tallest owl with a 5-foot wingspan.
It was unbelievable. And so all the bones were totally just crushed. Felt like I was kind of holding bubble wrap.
Rice says holding the owl felt like a gut punch. This was just one of several great grays struck and killed by vehicles this year.
These birds live in areas where they don't encounter people, and they are so camouflaged. I mean, their wings look like bark. Their body looks like a tree, and so they rely on that camouflage, and they don't think people can see them, right?
This winter is what's known as an eruption. That's with an I. It's the largest in Minnesota in 20 years. They occur after a lot of baby owls are hatched the year before, and then the following year, there's not enough food for all of them. So they fly south from Canada in droves in search of small rodents called voles.
We call it the invasion of the vole snatchers.
Sparky Stensas is executive director of Friends of Sacs-Zimbogue. The group has preserved about 25,000 acres of prime bird habitat in the region. He says the owls have brought an influx of people from around the world.
Boreal owls, great gray owls, they're bucket list birds for people. And that's why folks come here.
That's what brought Michelle Van Rossum here from Rhode Island with her friend and sister-in-law. They hired a guide to help them find owls to photograph.
I'm kind of obsessed with owls. Oh, they're just magical.
Van Rossum saw great gray owls hunting, a northern hawk owl, and a small boreal owl.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
But it's an end-of-a-lifetime for some of the owls. Several have been found dead along roadways. Others have been seriously injured. Valerie Slocum directs animal rehabilitation at the wildlife rehab center Wildwoods in Duluth.
There's one day we admitted 5 owls in one day.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a really big owl day, very unusual.
She says most were hit by vehicles.
Owls are predators, and so their eyes are fixed in the front of their face, and they don't have very good peripheral vision. And so if they're flying across the road, they don't necessarily see the car that's coming towards them.
Slocum and others plead with people to give owls space. Frank Nicoletti is senior researcher at Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory in Duluth.
If you get too close, they'll feel that there's a threat, and they will fly away. And when they waste energy flying away from people, which happens a lot, it's a problem because they're using energy to do that.
And he says the owls are already stressed and hungry. Naturalist Michaela Rice says people should get excited when they see these owls.
I blow them kisses. I do try to send love to them, but in a way that I feel like I'm not disturbing them.
Keep your distance, Rice says. Appreciate them, but give them the respect they deserve. For NPR News, I'm Dan Crocker in northern Minnesota.
Who brings you this story? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
What slashing federal agency budgets could mean for food safety.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishor, in for David Brancaccio. The Trump administration has fired more than 10,000 employees across the federal workforce, from the Federal Aviation Administration to the National Institutes of Health. It's also cut agency budgets, and some of these cuts have experts worried about what the layoffs and firing will mean for the nation's food safety. This week, the head of the Food and Drug Administration's Food Safety Division resigned, saying, according to multiple reports, that the cuts will damage the FDA's ability to safeguard our food supply. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
We still don't know the full extent of the layoffs at the FDA, which oversees the safety of most of our food supply. But Darren Detweiler, a food safety expert and consultant teaching at Northeastern University, says they are widespread.
These are technical experts, nutrition experts. Their jobs are extremely important in terms of outbreak response and disease investigation.
Frontline food inspectors and investigators have been laid off or fired, some because they were newer employees on probation.
This is going to result in slower recalls, weaker enforcement, and quite honestly, a rollback of public health protections.
The FDA did not respond to a request for comment by deadline. The USDA, which handles some aspects of food safety nationally, said in a statement that the agency is committed to preserving essential safety positions and will ensure that critical services remain uninterrupted. But many experts and former food safety officials are unconvinced.
I worry about if there is reduced oversight, that there will be an increase in foodborne outbreaks.
Howard Sklamberg is a partner at the law firm Arnold & Porter and spent years in a variety of positions at the FDA.
Will it occur tomorrow? No. But over the long term, if you reduce the oversight, you reduce the ability to create and implement standards. Does that affect the safety of the food supply? Yes.
In the meantime, the federal government's ability to respond to any crises in our food supply is reduced, says Peter Lurie, president of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, who was previously an associate commissioner at the FDA.
This will put a lot of pressure on state food inspectors, and quite a lot of food inspection does take place at the state level, but it's coordinated and standards are established by groups that have FDA at the very core.
That's not to say no one is minding the food supply. There are still thousands of people working at the FDA and other food safety agencies. Plus, says Donald Schaffner, a food microbiology professor at Rutgers.
Food safety people that work in the food industry, and there are thousands of us, right, are going to keep doing their jobs, right? And so that is not going to change.
Schaffner says there are already independent groups that keep an eye on food safety along with the government, plus food companies have every incentive to protect their reputations and avoid any health scares. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The justification from the Trump administration for the cuts to budgets in the federal workforce has been to eliminate waste and save money. Now, the president says there's talk amongst his advisors of sending some of that money taken away from federal agencies directly to taxpayers. And how much might that be? Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that.
In the last month, the Elon Musk-run Department of Government Efficiency has, on behalf of the Trump administration, laid off thousands of federal workers, including those tasked with health research, nuclear security, and wildfire response and prevention. The Trump administration has also frozen foreign aid, such as deliveries of food and medicines. Now, President Trump says his advisors are considering returning 20% of the savings back to taxpayers in the form of direct payments. Another 20% would go toward paying down debt. The president didn't say what the White House would do with the rest of the savings, although tax cuts are high on the president's priority list. How much in direct payments taxpayers get depends on the final numbers. The White House has claimed $55 billion in savings so far, while independent analysts have added up about $8.5 billion. At that last number, Bloomberg estimates Americans will get checks worth $11 per taxpayer. I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is down 576 points. That is 1.3%. The NASDAQ is down a full percent. The S&P 500 is down 0.9%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.511%. Passengers on that Delta flight that crash-landed in Toronto where the plane flipped upside down, everyone survived. Delta is offering them $30,000 each. Airlines are required by law to offer upfront payments to passengers to cover urgent needs. Delta said yesterday that all but one of the 21 injured passengers have been released from the hospital.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, aiming to help save time by offering smart business buying solutions so there's more time to focus on growing the business and less time doing the admin. More at AmazonBusiness.com.
We're going to get an update on existing home sales tomorrow from the National Association of Realtors. This week, we also got some news about the market for new homes. The contractors that build them are not feeling so great about the future. A survey from the National Association of Home Builders found their expectations for future sales fell to the lowest level in more than a year, mainly because of uncertainty about tariffs and how they might dramatically increase the cost of materials used to build homes. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Homebuilders rely on imported goods to make homes, including lumber, metals, and appliances.
And if their costs go up, that will translate into prices probably being higher than they would otherwise.
Nancy Vandenhouten is lead economist at Oxford Economics. She says higher input costs could discourage new construction, which has been adding much-needed supply to a tight housing market.
Would-be homeowners have, you know, faced a lot of hurdles for several years. And, you know, lack of new supply will, you know, only, you know, make those hurdles higher.
Another factor that could affect supply is the availability of workers. Charlie Dougherty, senior economist at Wells Fargo, says if the Trump administration continues to crack down on immigration,
that could be another sort of obstacle for home builders who may wish to expand supply but not be able to have the workers to do so.
As a result, Dougherty says home affordability probably won't improve much over the coming year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Lord, it is Matilda. Believe me, friends, it's Matilda. What it is at all? Matilda, she take me money and run Venezuela. Everybody.
Matilda.
What it is at all?
Matilda.
Lord, I got a fall.
Matilda, she take my money and run Venezuela.
$5,000, friends, a loss. The woman even sell me cat and horse. Oh, Lord. Matilda, she take me money and run Venezuela. Everybody.
Matilda.
What it is at all?
Matilda.
Lord, I got a fall.
Matilda, she take my money and run Venezuela.